Welcome everyone, I'm Spiro, thanks for tuning in. Today I'm very happy to welcome back to the show Dr. Andrew Kaufman. Dr. Kaufman, it's good to see you today. Thanks for taking the time to join me.
Yeah, it's great to be back, Spiro. I appreciate it.
The first time you were my guest, we talked about topics that apparently you're not allowed to talk about if you dare to question the official story, that is. Now, our last interview, we discussed the coronavirus, we covered the testing, and we covered the vaccine. And the video was quickly approaching 100,000 views, but YouTube removed the video after only a couple days. And to be honest, I would not be surprised if they take this video down as well. But thankfully, our first interview is still available for everyone to see on my BitChute channel and on your website as well. And I do encourage everyone to watch it. Take the time to see this report that was banned by YouTube. I'm going to leave a link in the show notes for that report, and it's titled, Dr. Andrew Kaufman, They Want to Genetically Modify Us with the COVID-19 Vaccine. Now, not only did YouTube remove this video, but Reuters, which is a massive international news publication, which news sites from all over the world get their talking points from, published a fact-checking report titled, False Claim, A COVID-19 Vaccine Will Genetically Modify Humans. Now, this official establishment fact-checking report is done by one of the biggest, if not the biggest, mainstream publication, and it's aimed directly at our previous interview where you and I are mentioned by name. Now, Dr. Kaufman, you are here today to respond to this fact-checking report, which I'm going to briefly read from. But before I do, any points you'd like to make, just because this is going to take a couple minutes to read this?
Yeah, sure. Well, I kind of think this is the closest that I'll ever get to a mainstream media interview. So I was actually kind of happy about it. And I knew it was important to use the term genetically modified organism because I stand by my initial statement and I'll explain later, but I think that's something that people are familiar with, and that's why I think it was threatening to the media establishment.
Okay, I'm going to go ahead and briefly read from this article here. It says, widely shared claims on social media linked to a video alleging that a future vaccine against COVID-19 would genetically modify humans. This claim is scientifically untrue. Examples of this claim can be seen here, here, and here, and here, and here. The article continues. Most claims refer to a version of a now deleted, widely shared YouTube video of Dr. Andrew Kaufman, a quote, natural healing consultant, in an interview with Spiro Skouras, an online personality and quote, independent researcher with a popular YouTube channel. In the video, Kaufman talks about how a future COVID-19 vaccine could provide a vessel to, quote, inject genes into humans, first by a procedure known as electroporation, in which an electric current creates little holes in your cells that allow DNA to go in our own cells, and then through the insertion of foreign proteins that supposedly generate immunity, end quote. Dr. Kaufman concludes that the vaccine, like results of biotechnology in agriculture, will make humans, quote, genetically modified organisms. Now, this article goes on to reference the World Health Organization saying that a DNA vaccine, quote, involves direct introduction into appropriate tissues of plasmid containing the DNA sequence encoding the antigen against which an immune response is sought and relies on the cytoproduction of the target antigen. That means that in contrast to the more widespread conventional vaccines, which use a whole pathogen or fragment, a DNA vaccine involves the injection of a small part of the virus genetic code, DNA or RNA, to stimulate immune response in a patient without an infection. The procedure does not create a genetically modified organism, which the Food and Agriculture Organization defines as an organism which one or more genes, called transgenes, have been introduced into its genetic material from another organism using recombinant DNA technology. Now, the article goes on to quote Mark Linus, a visiting fellow at Cornell University Alliance for Science Group, debunked the idea that a DNA vaccine could genetically modify an organism. Linus told Reuters that no vaccine can genetically modify human DNA. Quote, that's just a myth, one often spread intentionally by anti-vaccination activists to deliberately generate confusion and mistrust, he said. Quote, genetic modification would involve the deliberate insertion of foreign DNA into the nucleus of a human cell, and vaccines simply don't do that. Vaccines work by training the immune system to recognize a pathogen when it attempts to infect the body. This is mostly done by the injection of viral antigens or weakened live viruses that stimulate an immune response through the production of antibodies. Now, this article continues to go on. I'm not going to read the entire article, but it will be linked below. But basically, according to the fact checkers at Reuters, their verdict is this report is false. That our previous interview that Dr. Kaufman, yourself, and I did, where you were saying that this new COVID vaccine could genetically modify humans is false. They say a future COVID-19 vaccine will not genetically modify humans. DNA vaccines do not integrate the virus DNA into human cell nucleus, which seems to be their whole point, their whole thesis behind their point fact-checking this previous video that we did. Now, you said before that you stand by your claims. Can you please elaborate on that? What is your take, like, on when you first had seen this? You said, wow, this is an extremely important topic, of course, but, you know, I'd like to get your take and what was your initial response?
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, just a couple of general points about this article. One is it seems to confound the traditional vaccine technology, as they mentioned, which injects a piece of a virus or a full virus, with this new technology that they're trying to develop for the COVID vaccine, which involves DNA primarily, and there's at least one candidate for an RNA vaccine. So this is a totally different technology, and I would talk about them separately. The other thing is it mentions something about putting a protein into the cell, but that's not the case either. It's putting genetic material into the cell. So I'd like to kind of elaborate and give a little bit of background on biology in case the audience has not studied molecular biology before. So I'm going to go ahead and share screens so that you can see this. So this is just a simple article. Actually, it's a little bit more advanced, but I'm going to make it simple. And this is was taught to me is called the central dogma of biology. Okay, the DNA on the top here in this double-stranded helix formation is what contains our genetic information. And it's passed down, you know, from parent to child, and it's in every cell in our body pretty much. And what happens is when our cells wanted to make products, and the main products we make are proteins, what we do is that this strand unwinds, and a piece of it is called transcribed, they put transcription here, and made into RNA. And RNA has the direct code for the protein. And the DNA is in the nucleus, and it makes the RNA inside the nucleus, and then the RNA goes outside the nucleus into the other parts of the cell, specifically the ribosomes is where proteins are made. So what happens is that there are other little pieces of RNA they don't show here called transfer RNA, and they're coupled to one amino acid at a time, and they basically line up according to these sequences. Each three of these letters codes for one amino acid, and those are the building blocks of the protein. So basically you have DNA transcribed to RNA, then RNA moves outside of the nucleus into the cell, in the cytoplasm, and to the ribosomes where it's made into proteins. And that's essentially how everything in our cell is made. So as you said on the article here, it says that it would basically not involve the insertion of foreign DNA into the nucleus. And that's the main argument of why they feel what I claimed was incorrect. So if we go to this article here from Medscape, now Medscape is an online resource for physicians, pretty much. Most physicians have like an account with them, and they send regular updates about important medical issues, and it's a reference site. So if you're like working in a hospital or in a clinic and you need to look something up, Medscape is one of the references. And so they have this article here written by doctors from the University of Michigan about DNA vaccines, and they basically explain how the DNA vaccines work. And so there's a nice little picture here, and you can see that it shows this is the piece of DNA in a circular form they call a plasmid. It's based on a structure of DNA that comes from bacterial cells originally, and it would have the gene that they're trying to put into us that they say is from a coronavirus. And you can see that it goes across the cell membrane here through the cytoplasm and into the nucleus. And right here in the text below, It says the plasmid DNA vaccine carries the genetic code for a piece of pathogen or tumor antigen. The plasmid vector is taken up to the cells and transcribed in the nucleus. So that's exactly what it does, what the Reuters article misquotes, that this DNA from the vaccine has to go in the nucleus because that's where it's made into RNA. There's no machinery to make it to RNA in the cell membrane, in the cytoplasm. So it does go into the nucleus. Thus, it is a genetically modification of our own bodies. Now, I thought I'd go into a little bit more detail about this for those people who like more detail and look at a specific vaccine candidate. And this is, by the way, being developed at the Department of Ophthalmology, quite an interesting place for a vaccine development to go on, at Harvard Medical School. But they do gene therapy there, which is a similar technology. Did you have something you wanted to interject?
Yes, Dr. Kupman, if you could just clarify for the viewers and for myself, what is exactly ophthalmology there?
Oh, sure. Ophthalmology is the medical specialty that is treats eye diseases. So perhaps there's a genetic eye disease that their researchers there were developing gene therapy for, which is very similar technology where you want to alter the genes of the cells to overcome whatever's causing the disease. So I think that's why these researchers got into the coronavirus game. But they basically develop a gene-based strategy with a DNA vaccine, just like we talked about, and they're using the background material. So they're going to put a gene from what they say is the COVID-19 virus, but they're going to put it inside the background of an adeno-associated viral vector. So that's basically adenovirus or adenovirus, it's pronounced both ways, is another common type of virus that's associated with the common cold, just like coronaviruses are. And so they're using genetic material from an adenovirus and putting the COVID-19 gene inside of it. So I wanted to see, well, how do adenoviruses replicate? And so I found this article here about adenoviruses. And basically, it might be hard to find the right spot here.
And the source of this, and the source of this is the NIH.gov website?
Yeah, so this is from the Cold Spring Harbor Perspectives in Biology, which is a peer-reviewed journal, and this is on the PubMed website from the, you know, Library of Medicine. And here it says, members of the family Adenoviridae, which is adenoviruses, are non-envelope, blah, 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 that replicate in the nucleus. So once again, they're basically using the genetic sequence from this virus to target it to the nucleus. So now we have two separate types of evidence to show that this is actually the strategy with DNA vaccines.
That's pretty profound, because the whole basis of their argument, as you pointed out, for trying to debunk what you had previously claimed in our previous interview, was that what they were injecting into, I'll go ahead and read this again. They say, quote, and this is the visiting fellow Mark Linus from the Cornell University Alliance of Science Group, of course, trying to debunk what you claimed by saying, quote, that's just a myth, one often spread intentionally by anti-vaxxers. Of course, they want to throw that in there as a derogatory term to try to discredit and you know, move away the idea of, you know, of engaging in a debate about this. Now, they go on to say that genetic modification would involve the deliberate insertion of foreign DNA into the nucleus of a human cell, and vaccines simply don't do that. And you just showed two sources from legitimate sources that actually say exactly what this does. I mean, is that injecting? They're injecting DNA, right? Or DNA or RNA into the nucleus, essentially.
Yeah, well, these examples are specifically DNA, which is the most common strategy that's being attempted.
Interesting. Please continue, Dr. Kaufman.
So, you know, in thinking about this and doing some research, since they haven't isolated any virus or showed a genome that they could say comes from a virus, we just have basically this random genetic sequences, and for what they call a spike protein. So I was thinking, you know, well, would they really be using that sequence or would they be using other things? And so this is where, you know, I get into a little bit of speculation, but there are essentially a number of technologies that are available, some on the cutting edge and some have been around for a long time, of how they could use this type of strategy to really do some harm and alter us even more permanently. Because even with the DNA going into the nucleus, if that cell divides, then that DNA will be in the daughter cell, but it won't be in the offspring. So in other words, if you get the vaccine and then you have children, your children won't have this foreign DNA. But they do have a technology, and I'll share my screen again here so we can see, called the CRISPR technology. And it's actually called gene drives. And it's based on the CRISPR technology. And some people may have heard of this. What a CRISPR is it's a specific sequence of genetic material that's derived from a bacteria that can go into a specific location in our chromosomes and basically cut out the gene that's there and replace it with whatever it's attached to. And this Cas9 is an enzyme that helps carry that out. So there's a little 2-minute video. Would it be okay if I showed this? Because I think it's quite telling. And this video explains the technology, and the goal is basically to insert a foreign gene into a host organism. In this case, they're talking about mosquitoes, but then they want that to be passed down to future generations, which would mean that it basically become part of the bloodline. So take a look at this.
Historically, scientists have been able to alter the traits of domesticated plants and animals, but have not been able to do this to wild populations. Here we use mosquitoes as an example to explain why most genome alterations designed by humans don't persist in nature and how a recently proposed technology could change that. The transgenic mosquito, tinted blue, has an altered gene inserted into one of its chromosomes. When it mates with the wild-type mosquito, each parent contributes one copy of each chromosome to their offspring. Thus, only 50% of offspring will carry the altered gene, while the other half will inherit the wild-type version from both parents. Even if the altered gene doesn't reduce the likelihood of each mosquito surviving and reproducing, it may persist at a low frequency in the ocean of wild mosquitoes, or it might go extinct after several generations of especially unlucky inheritance. This process is what keeps us from altering wild mosquitoes to prevent them from transmitting diseases such as malaria or dengue. A team led by Kevin Esfeldt at the Wyss Institute, the Harvard Medical School, and the Harvard School of Public Health has now outlined a way to build gene drives that can improve the odds that almost any altered gene will be inherited, potentially allowing them to spread through even wild populations. The proposal relies on the CRISPR-Cas9 system, a new genome editing technology co-developed by the same researchers at the Wyss. Gene drive mosquitoes carry both the altered gene, the genes for the Cas9 enzyme, and several guide RNAs that tell it where to cut. When passed to offspring, the guide RNAs direct Cas9 to cut the wild-type version of the gene inherited from the wild-type parent. The cell then copies both the altered gene and the drive when it repairs the damage. Because the mosquito now has two identical copies, one on each chromosome, all of its offspring will inherit the alteration and the gene drive. This same process will be repeated in subsequent generations, causing the alteration and the gene drive to spread through the population.
So this is a picture of the chromosomes where this light blue gene is the foreign gene that they're inserting, and the blue mosquito has it. And here's where it will cut out the gene that's normally in the mosquito and replace it with this one. And that's how this technology works. And eventually you'll end up with basically all of the offspring a couple of generations down the road expressing this foreign gene. So this is a way to sort of permanently genetically modify us. And this technology has been developed and it seems like it's ready for deployment. So some other things that I think could be done with these vaccines have to do with fertility. So I found several review articles on PubMed, and this one is from the American Journal of Reproductive Immunology, another peer-reviewed journal. And it's basically anti-sperm contraceptive vaccines, where we are and where we're going. So this is pretty scary stuff. And this is from 2011, so it's already 9 years old. And in this one, they used animals, but they were able to block reproduction in those animals. But that's not it, because that's on the male side. But on the female side, we have this article, and this one is 23 years old, from 1997, from the American Journal of Reproductive Immunology also, where there is a vaccine that prevents pregnancy in women by creating antibodies to HCG. And HCG is the molecule that you test for in a pregnancy test. And it's not the only one.
And the source of that first one, again, that was, it looked like an NIH.gov site. Yes. There.
Yes, all these are from PubMed, which is like a free source that you can search for any kind of medical articles. They might not all be available for free, but many of them are. And then there's one more, more recent one about, again, creating immunity against the sperm to develop infertility. So this is, you know, of course, they describe this as being useful as a contraceptive, but this is the kind of thing that I worry about that could be added to a vaccine without acknowledgement, because there are many, many ingredients that are in vaccines already that we really, there's no disclosure of. They're not listed on the product labeling, and they're considered. Yeah.
I hate to interrupt, but if you could stop sharing your screen there for me, that would be great.
Yes. Thought I did already. Is that better?
Yeah. Can you go back to, you know, you were getting into, like, they're saying that this could be used as a contraceptive. You know, like, what, could you please pick up right there?
Yeah, well, basically they would give you a vaccine, a one-time injection, right, which would be perhaps more convenient than, you know, using condoms or taking a monthly pill. That, and they say it's reversible, but, you know, it's hard to say because these are just experiments. But they definitely showed that it affected fertility. So, you know, I don't think too many people would be lining up to get a vaccine that would make them sterile. But this technology is existing.
And they've been working on it for quite some time. And this does fall in line with the eugenics population control that many have talked about is connected to these groups who are behind in the funding and the development of these vaccines and these vaccine campaign programs, global programs to, you know, vaccinate the entire global population, which is clearly what they stated they want to achieve with this brand new experimental COVID-19 vaccine, which, in my opinion, I mean, I'm not a doctor or a scientist, but based off of the information that you just presented right here, I would say that the fact checkers over at Reuters need to go back to the drawing board, because you and I have only briefly exchanged a couple of emails in an attempt just to schedule this interview here today. You haven't told me what you had found or what you were going to present. I had no idea what you were going to say. I wasn't sure if you were going to say, well, you know, they were just using semantics and you know, I mean, because it could try to go off in a different way, because we've seen that before where they try to use a play on words to try to debunk a conspiracy theory. But clearly, I feel that you have demonstrated it here, just showing right there that they are using, they are injecting DNA into the nucleus, which does then genetically modify. And then you went on to show how there are other applications through gene drive technology and CRISPR, which have been mentioned is in the Fourth Industrial Revolution's program from the World Economic Forum of their future for humanity that they are envisioning for us. So, you know, that in addition to the population control, what you just showed there, the sterilization of people through these vaccines, which goes back to eugenics. I mean, it's just unbelievable to see. It is right there in medical journals on NIH.gov PubMed websites. It's kind of blowing my mind right now to see this, just as a matter of fact, you know?
Yeah, it's quite scary and overwhelming. And, I just want to point out that all of the information I report on comes from medical journals, peer-reviewed articles, and government websites. I don't report on things from, dubious sources or questionable sources even. I try to really keep things in the mainstream because all this information is out there. And it's just a matter of being able to look for it and identify it. And, you can see that if they combine these technologies, it could be, quite devastating for our future.
Absolutely. And just to, in the means of transparency, are you anti-vax? Because they kind of insinuated that you were an anti-vaxxer trying to intentionally spread disinformation to mislead people. Obviously, I don't believe that's what your presentation here has depicted of you, but I mean, I'll ask you directly, do you consider yourself to be anti-vaccine, Dr. Kaufman?
Yeah, well, I don't really like those kind of labels, like a vaccine denier, or I'm certainly not a vaccine activist. I don't go and march and hold up signs at City Hall. I've evaluated carefully the research on vaccines, and I haven't found any credible evidence that vaccines are beneficial. And I have found lots of scientific evidence that vaccines cause much, much harm. I mean, I think that quite a lot of our chronic illnesses, especially in children, are a result of vaccines, and I have lots of experience working individually. And I think what's really compelling, because the establishment has really tried to cover up this research and not provide research funding really to look at it. Like, for example, there's no large study comparing children who receive vaccines versus who haven't received vaccines. There's also a law was passed that prevents you from suing a vaccine manufacturer for liability, of product liability. So if you get injured, you can't even sue them. So they have no financial incentive to make vaccines safe. So after looking at all this kind of evidence, and really the most compelling thing is just hearing from parents. And, there are lots of video interviews of parents giving their account. And I've also been working directly with lots of families who with vaccine injured children. And, you hear the same story over and over again, which is basically my child was perfectly normal and healthy. Then they had vaccine X, and within hours to days, they were extremely ill, or a totally different person, or lost the ability to use language, or had to be in the hospital with encephalitis. And then, of course, there's the VAERS database, the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, which is a voluntary mechanism that the FDA puts out to report adverse reactions from vaccines. And according to a study from Harvard, it represents less than 1% of all the vaccine injuries. And that was a study that was funded by the CDC, but it was later, the funding was withdrawn and they were asked not to publish their findings. So you can only find the results of that in like a newspaper type story, not in a scientific journal. But if you look at the VAERS database, you'll see things like sudden death, like Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is becoming paralyzed. So, I mean, very, very serious complications and side effects from vaccines. So I think there's a really, in my opinion, overwhelming evidence. So given that they're not effective and they're shown to cause a lot of harm, I don't know who would research and come to that conclusion and support giving vaccines. So I certainly don't support the use of vaccines.
Now, a recent survey that was conducted by Fox Business, so take it with what you will, found that 7 out of 10 people worry about the safety of the COVID-19 vaccine. Now, we're seeing a lot of talk about potentially mandating vaccines. We've had people come out and write some very strong op-eds saying that, hey, the debate is over, basically, kind of like with the climate change, right? The debate's over. The science is settled. Your time, you don't have the right to, endanger others because you're not vaccinated, right? That's kind of their argument to this, because people would say, well, if you are vaccinated, what are you worried about if I'm vaccinated or not, right? Well, they're saying that you don't have a right during an infectious disease, like a pandemic, like what we're supposedly going through right now. You don't have the right to be not vaccinated because you're endangering the community. And so there's been a lot of talk about possible mandatory vaccines. We've seen a senator from New Zealand come out and say this, but we've also seen some pushback. Oh, we've also seen a law group out of New York saying, hey, it's time to mandate the vaccine. So there's been a lot of push towards that, but we've also seen some victories against mandatory vaccinations. Recently in Canada, a mandatory vaccine bill, which would have removed exemptions, got voted down, and the same thing happened in Kazakhstan. So, you know, I mean, there are some victories around the world, but, you know, I think that there's a major push coming here potentially in the U.S. as the first round of this vaccine is potentially just a couple of months away, as they're saying it could be here as early as October. I think I already know the answer to this based on your last question. I wouldn't think that you supported mandatory vaccination based on what you just said. But I mean, you know what, you know, we've seen Alan Dershowitz come out recently and say that the same thing, that there is a legal precedent set by the Jacobson versus Massachusetts case that was upheld by the Supreme Court, where the local legislature in Massachusetts had the authority, the police state authority, to mandate vaccines. I mean, what is your overall take on this as this vaccine approaches?
Well, I'm certainly not a legal expert, but I know that there were several legal scholars that argued against Dershowitz's claim using that case law. I just don't believe that it is ethical and within the Constitution to force a medical procedure, because we're not talking about something that is without risk. We're talking about piercing the skin with a sharp object, right? If this were done against your will, it would be an assault. It also violates the United Nations Treaty, which is based on the Nuremberg Code, which basically prohibits an experimental medical procedure from being forced on an individual. And, you know, this is definitely an experimental procedure with this current vaccine, because one is that they skipped animal studies for toxicity. They went right to human trials, and this is a way to fast track it. But there's going to be no real clinical data that is going to be sufficient enough to determine what the true toxicity and harm is. And we also won't know that it's actually successful at doing what they say that it will do. So I'm enthusiastic about South Dakota. You mentioned Canada and was it Kazakhstan? But South Dakota, now this hasn't been voted on yet, but they have a bill actually that would prevent any medical procedure whatsoever from being mandated, even for the purpose of attending school or any other purpose in civil society. So I think that would be a much more ethical approach. The arguments about herd immunity that you hear being discussed, that if everyone's not vaccinated, that the disease is still going to affect people, it really doesn't make sense. And I think it's just a way to justify the policy. And, you know, there are two reasons it doesn't make sense. One is because, as you pointed out, if the vaccine protects you as an individual, then you're protected. So whatever anyone else decides to do won't affect you directly. And then the second reason is that herd immunity is purely theoretical and has never been proven. In fact, we've never had herd immunity for any condition because we only immunize children. And if you believe that immunity works the way they say it does with the vaccines, they'll admit that it wears off. It's not lifelong. But they don't require boosters in adults. They often recommend tetanus and flu shots, but for all the other diseases, you know, measles, mumps, rubella, diphtheria, pertussis, et cetera, there's no boosters. So since children of vaccine age only make up a very small percentage of the overall population, we've never come close to 80 or 90% immunity based on that. So there's really no real world data that backs up herd immunity at all. It's just a concept that is theoretical and is used for this purpose to justify, you know, vaccinating everyone.
Dr. Kaufman, I want to go back to something that you touched on earlier, that, you know, very early on, you were saying how they have not yet isolated the virus and therefore actually proving that, hey, here is the virus. I mean, we've seen all these computer animations and pictures of it, but actually seeing this is the virus, this is what it looks like, right? So now you've been keeping up on this throughout this pandemic, and I assume, and you know, so if that's the case, if they haven't been able to isolate the virus, then how are they able to determine that there's, you know, we've seen, heard, you know, two dozen different strains, or how many different strains of COVID going around? How are they able to determine that if they haven't been able to isolate the virus?
Yeah, well, basically what they've been doing is repeating the same procedure that I described earlier. So they still haven't done anything different to demonstrate that they can purify and isolate a virus. And essentially what they do is they have a cell culture of some kind of foreign cells, usually monkey cells, and they add a body fluid or a nasal swab to that. And then they add some toxic chemicals like a serum from a calf, antibiotics, and things like that. Then they observe it for several days while feeding it only minimal nutrition. And then they see cell damage. And they show the cell damage under a microscope, and sometimes they show different particles. And when cells are in a process of dying, they extrude all types of particles. One of which is exosomes. And we know that when you mix antibiotics with cells, you're going to create exosomes because that's well established in the scientific literature. What they're doing with the genetics is a little bit different. And this gets to why they say that they have different strains. So what they did initially is that they had taken the body fluid. It was the lung fluid in the first study. And they used predetermined sequences to make probes for a PCR test. And those predetermined sequences come from a database or a library of genetic sequences. And they say that these are from viruses, or specifically coronaviruses. But the thing is that all of the other experiments that determined those sequences were all done with the same procedure. So it's like, where did the original one come from? You get into that kind of a tautology. But what they do is, so then they use that probe and it matches something. And, you know, the probes are very similar to our own DNA as well. So it could actually match our own DNA. And then they amplify, using the PCR process, that specific sequence. But it would be a very short strand, maybe 200 to 300 bases maximum. And they then generate other probes that are mostly either based on those sequences or from that library. And they get basically a whole batch of different short strands of genetic material that who knows how they're related to each other. And some of them overlap and sometimes there's gaps, but they piece these together in like a computer model. And that computer model shows that it's like 30,000 base pairs long. So you can imagine how many of these short little strands they have to string together, right? So I describe this as kind of like a Frankenstein monster construct. And when all is said and done, they say that it's the complete genome. But if you wanted to get a complete genome, what you would do is you would purify out the viral particle so that it was the only thing that was in your test tube. And then you could break apart the membrane and have the genetic material in the solution intact in one long strand, right? Inside the supposed viral particles, just like inside the nucleus of our cells, the genetic material is in one piece, right? In a virus, it's one piece. And in us, we have chromosomes, so there are multiple because we have way, way more genetic material than a virus. A virus is extremely simple. But they've never done this, where they could take out that one piece from something that they've identified that they know is the viral particle, and then they could sequence it end to end. And then if they did this, if it were even possible, then they would show that's the actual genome of that virus. But since they piece it together from all these tiny little fragments, when they do this in different people, because they're working from a dirty sample, right? The lung fluid, if they're using that, for example, well, it has lung cells, it has immune cells, it has exosomes, it has bacteria, fungi, and multiple species of those. It may even have free genetic material, so it's a big genetic mess. And so in different people in different places, they're going to have different fragments of DNA because those people's DNA are different. They have different bacteria and funguses and whatever else is contributing to that sample. So, and then because of the error in how they piece it together, it's operator dependent. So all of these different sources of error create variations in this sequence, and then they say, you know, that those are different mutations or, you know, subspecies or whatever terminology they use.
Interesting. So essentially, there may not be multiple different strains or as many as they say, just due to the process and the methods that they use in trying to reconstruct the said virus?
Well, I'm saying that there's actually nothing at all because they haven't actually found the virus to take the genetic material from. So who knows where this genetic material that they're just putting in this hypothetical theoretical model comes from. It's basically just a created construct, right? It's almost analogous to the CGI images they show of the virus that are just an artist's rendering. Like this is maybe like a genetic artist's rendering of a genome.
Interesting. Now, Dr. Kaufman, since we are on the topic of GMOs and vaccines, and I know we've already been going for a little while here, and we don't want to take up too much of your time. I know you're very busy. But since we are on the topic of GMOs and vaccines, have you seen some of the experimental vaccines which are actually labeled as a GMO itself? And here is an example I'm going to share with you. This comes from the Genetic Literacy Project from March 2020 titled, "There appears to be a coronavirus vaccine on the horizon, but it's a GMO, and the FDA would need to approve testing." I didn't share this with you before we started recording, and I don't know if you had seen that, but this is some of the new types of methods where they're actually calling the vaccine itself a GMO. And then here is another example we have from Cornell Alliance for Science titled, "GMO Tomato as Edible COVID Vaccine? Mexican scientists work to make it a reality, and they are currently working to engineer a tomato to contain a COVID vaccine. And so when you eat the tomato, you become inoculated." What are your thoughts on this, Dr. Kaufman?
Well, I'd rather eat a tomato than take a shot, for sure. But, you know, maybe it takes a GMO to make a GMO. The GMO vaccine, basically what they're telling you is that they're going to make the sequence of what they call the viral spike protein using a genetically modified organism. So probably a bacteria, but I don't know for sure. And so what they would do is they would put that genetic material into the bacteria and have the bacteria replicate it somehow, and then they would use that to manufacture the vaccine. And with the tomato, a very similar thing. It's almost like they'd be actually vaccinating the tomato, right? Using the same strategy that I described earlier in the DNA vaccines. And then I guess that tomato would have the antigen in it. And, you know, it's interesting, like, to talk about the food, because if you really want to take advantage of how our body's natural immunity works, is that when we eat things, in the back of our throat, we have a tonsillar ring. And, you know, some people get this surgically removed or parts of it. But what that is that is part of your immune system. It's lymph tissue. And that's the natural way for our body to learn about what's in our environment, because our immune system wants to know what's around us, and that in case any of those things are problematic, it knows what to do with them, and it can be aware. So it's like information. And this is actually why young children, babies, you know, infants, put everything in their mouth. They're basically sampling the environment for their immune system so that it could be prepared in case those things, you know, get through your skin or enter your body in some other way. Because when you eat something, it's actually technically outside your body. So, right, because it goes through a tube that goes, you know, through from one end of your body all the way to the other, and only certain things go through that tube into the body internally. So, you know, that would definitely be a more biologically natural way to create immunity to something if that were possible.
Dr. Kaufman, I want to thank you very much for your time here. And I just wanted to ask you one last question. If you had anything that you would like to say to the Reuters fact checkers before you go, or any other points you'd like to share with us today.
Well, you know, I mean, the Reuters fact checkers, they're doing their job to uphold the mainstream story and narrative. And, you know, it was a good try, but they should check a little bit more carefully next time for sure. And maybe they'll follow up with a criticism of the things we talked about today, and we'll have another opportunity. But in general, I just, you know, want to once again encourage people also not to take what I say at face value and just trust it either, that I encourage people to do your own research, check my sources. I think I gave a pretty good references for these things, but you should look for yourself, make sure that you agree, make your own opinion. And that's what we all really need to be doing. And even if your opinion disagrees with me, that's no problem at all. If you actually, you know, did some learning about what's going on so that you could make an informed opinion and not just trust, you know, a talking head or an authority figure.
Well said, Dr. Kaufman. Again, thank you so much for being my guest today. I look forward to having you back again soon. And you know what? The invitation extends to the fact checkers and the experts that they had on for their fact checking piece. If they would like to come on and talk about this, and if you're willing, Dr. Kaufman, would you be willing to, if you wanted to have a debate or a discussion about this?
Yeah, I mean, if they were open-minded to discuss it, yeah, I'd be more than welcome that opportunity.
Okay, well, there it is. There's the official invite. Anytime, you're more than welcome to come on my show. I really enjoyed having you on. There was some very important, thought-provoking information. And based on, you know, where I'm standing, and of course, people would say that I have a bias in this. I myself am not anti-vax. I don't consider myself anti-vax. I believe that people should have the choice of what they decide to do with their bodies and their medical decisions. It should not be forced upon people. And, you know, and this is a debate and a discussion that needs to be had. You know, we need to be talking about this kind of stuff, about what are they actually doing with these new experimental shots, these new experimental vaccines, and, you know, what are going to be the outcomes? What are going to be the, you know, because we really don't know. I mean, this is experimental. It's never been done before. And as you pointed out, there is some very interesting technology which could be used, you would think or hope, to benefit humanity, but we really just don't know. And when you start to look at the population control aspects of it, it definitely raises many, many concerns. And again, Dr. Andrew Kaufman, the best place to find your work is at andrewkaufmanmd.com. Thanks so much, and look forward to having you back again soon.
Great. It would be my pleasure, Spiro.
Fantastic.